Alrighty, well, it seems like we were just here 2 weeks ago. Got to teach Sunday school, and so last week in teen class, we kept going and we didn't get very far, so we're basically picking up where we left off last time. So we're going to be in 1 Timothy 3. I'm sure it had nothing to do with me taking rabbit trails or anything, because that never happens. Alrighty, 1 Timothy. So as we were saying last time, what we're doing is we're going through the church and the offices involved in the church. We're talking local church, and going to be leading up to doing a church history lesson, but we wanted to cover the local church first. So we've covered the pastors, and just a refresher that we established that these, if you want to call them qualifications, are not just for pastors. These are for any Christian. And so as we go through these, same goes with deacons and whatnot, that these requirements, if you want to call it that, are for any Christian. And we established that last time. But we kept going down in verse 1 Timothy 3, and we covered the deacons. I can't remember if it was in this hour or maybe it was last week with the teens. But we did establish, and we go down to, just trying to get caught up. We ended with verse 9, holding the mystery of faith in a pure conscience. Verse 10, and let these also first be proved, and let them use the office of a deacon, being found blameless. Even so must their wives be grave, not slanderers, sober, faithful in all things. And there's a lot of correlations, like we said last time, with the bishop and the deacon, how a lot of the admonitions are tied together, but there are certain things that are different. He'll tell the bishop, he'll give him one admonition, he'll give the deacon something else because of the challenges that they're going to face in that specific position. But there are some similarities. There, even with a deacon and the deacon's wife, look at verse 8. Likewise must the deacons be grave. We studied that last time, that how they have a tendency to not be as sober and serious about the matter and taking the gravity of the situation. So he's telling them and forewarning them that make sure when you step into this position that you're grave, you understand the gravity of what you're getting yourself into. And if you hold your finger right there in verse 8 where it says grave, hold your finger there, but then go down where he's admonishing the wives. Even so, in verse 11, even so must their wives be grave. And so they need to understand the gravity of what they're getting themselves into as well. And not that she's holding a position, but there's a duty for her to be a help, meet unto her husband. And she has a big part in assisting him. It's going to make his job a lot easier if she's doing her part. Now, I say that because they're both told to be grave. And as soon as he gets done telling them to be grave and understand what you're getting yourself into, the gravity of this situation, the next two admonitions for both of them, look at verse 8. To the deacon, he says, not double-tongued. So that has to do with your words. Verse 11, to the deacon's wife, he says, not slanderers. Two different things, but it both has to do with what comes out of your mouth. And so he says, look, realize the gravity of the situation that you're getting yourself into. Don't take this lightly. And to both the husband and the wife, he says, watch your tongue. And that is going to be a temptation for anybody, but it apparently he says this for deacons as well, because we covered last time with the deacon, he may have one opinion that may differ from the pastor. He's going to have to watch not to be double-tongued and to be spreading rumors. Same with the deacon's wife, not to be a slander. And like I said, this goes for any Christian. Let's turn to James 3. And as, like I said, we covered a little bit of this last week, so I'm going to try to blow through the first part of this fairly quickly, but we just want to keep on the same page here. We're going to be back and forth with 1 Timothy 3, so you can keep a marker there. But James 3 is obviously a very common passage on the tongue. And I gave them for a memory verse last week, Proverbs 18:21. It says that death and life are in the power of the tongue. And so, once again, realizing how sobering that is, that he says, look, you need to be grave. Why? Because the tongue controls death and life. If you want to think of a a bad person. Everyone's, you know, who's the worst person to ever live? You know, you got, you know, Mussolini and all these, with Al Capone and all these. But for some reason, Adolf Hitler always hits the top. What was his big crime? His words. He stirred up people. He spoke, and millions of Jews died. His biggest crime was the words that he said. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. A king, a monarch, has no power unless his authority doesn't mean anything until he speaks a word and stamps his stamp of approval. If a person comes into the courtroom and the king doesn't like him, he can speak one word and off with his head. Because death and life are in the power of the tongue. Whatever comes out where a word of a king is, there's power. And so a lot of people don't realize what influence the tongue has. So we're going to go through James 3 here and take our time because of the severity of the consequences of your tongue. Now, I said that Proverbs says that death and life are in the power of the tongue. Think about someone about to jump off a bridge and you approach them. There's ways to approach someone in that situation, and you have to be very cautious because the words that come out of your mouth could mean the difference between them jumping off the bridge or coming back and reasoning with you. And so death and life are in the power of what you say. And there's a lot of people that have an opinion about personalities, and I do or don't like this person. 90% of what makes you you is what comes out of your mouth, whether you're quiet, whether you're loud, how you say things, how you approach people. But a lot of it has to do, what people think about you is a lot of what comes out of your mouth. And so you need to realize what an impact and what a weight that carries. And so to both the deacon and the deacon's wife, he says, watch your tongue. Don't be double-tongued. And to the deacon's wife, don't be a slanderer. And he, amidst that, he says to be grave. And later on, we'll read that he says to be sober. So it's a very serious topic. Don't take this lightly. James chapter 3, though. My brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. For in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths, that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole bodies. Behold, also the ships, which though they be so great, are driven a fierce wind, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. Even so the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire doth kindle. And you have, I don't know how much horses weigh. I'm not a horse guy, but a couple hundred pounds is reasonable. How much do you think that bit weighs? I mean, that thing is less than 1% of the size of that horse. And yet you give it a little tug this way or that way, unless it's a wild horse. Most of the time, it'll turn, and that huge, impressive animal, I told him last week, I said, to me, a horse is a muscle with four legs. I mean, it's just a beefy animal, and there's other stronger animals, but they can't run as fast. They're not as powerful, and to think that that entire animal is controlled by something about 4 inches long, maybe 6 inches long, depending on how big it is, but it's controlled by that little thing, and the entire movement of that beast is driven by something that long, and your entire... your perception of how people perceive you is completely derived by something that long in your mouth called a tongue. And he says, watch it, because it's going to drive the entirety of your life. And the direction you go is going to be controlled by that tongue. He says, how great a matter a little fire to kindle. He also likens a tongue to a ship. And the ship, the helm at the front is what stirs the udder, and it's very small. You can take it with one hand most of the time and just a light push will turn it one way if the winds are good. And you can steer that thing just by a gentle push of the hand. It's multiple tons of wood that are on that ship. And it can be turned by just doing this. Just turning. Now I understand it's probably going to take a little more if you're in a storm, okay? But I'm just saying, compared to the ship, it's a very small helm. And whether that ship crashes into an iceberg or whether that ship lands in the harbor is determined by what direction that helm goes. And so it's a very small part of that ship, but it has the greatest impact. You can have good working sails, you can all have all that stuff, but unless that helm is working, something's going to go dead wrong. And so we ended last week with the team saying that, you know, okay, so what's the solution? We keep on saying how serious this tongue is. Well, then I just won't open my mouth, and that'll solve everything. Okay, we'll try that with the ship. Try just saying, okay, I'm going to make a mistake with the helm, so I'm just not going to touch it. Well, you're going to hit an iceberg. You're getting, something bad is going to happen. You don't take control of that horse and steer that thing, you're going to end up in the thorns, or you're going to end up in the enemy's camp, or something wrong is going to something bad is going to happen, because it's not saying to just get your hands off of it. It's saying you need to control it. Understand that what you do with that tongue is going to guide the rest of your life. And so he's not saying just take your hands off and we'll just let the winds take us where they are. You're in control of it, and you need to control your tongue. So in verse 6, keep going in chapter 3 here. 3:6, and the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and the center of fire of hell. It spreads, they say, like wildfire. And why is it that bad news always travels quicker than good news? Why is it that it takes, you know, months and months and months to build a structure like this, and it takes about one day to burn it down? Why is it that, you know, good news happens all the time, not all the time, but not as bad as, not as often as you would like. But it's interesting. Why is it that when something bad happens, everyone's so quick to spread rumors and spreads like wildfire and just consumes? Why is it that the good news doesn't spread like that? It says that cold water to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a far country. And it takes a long time for that news to get here. But if something bad were to happen, that would spread like wildfire. He says, your tongue is a fire. It's a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members. And it says it defileth, once again, the whole body. It's not just that it's defiling your words. It's defiling everything about you. You are defined a lot by what you say. And you need to understand the gravity of this and grasp that it's the tongue is a little member, just like the bit and the helm. But it's set on fire, the course of nature is set on fire of hell. Verse 7, for every kind of beast and of birds and of serpents and of things in the sea is tamed and hath been tamed by mankind. But the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poisons. I don't know if I really grasped what that said before studying this out. But it says that every kind of beast, there have been people that have tried to tame tigers and lions and have been semi-successful. I've seen people, play with lions and tigers. I wouldn't do it, but I'm saying hypothetically you could. But what is that? That's like you trying to tame a tiger is like you trying to tame your tongue. You can get it to maybe flash a light like a cat and chase it around. You can maybe treat it to not eat you. You can train it to do certain things to act more domestic, if you want to put it that way. But you can never take that nature out of the lion. You can never take, there's something inside that lion. It's a carnivore. It wants meat. And don't look now, but you're meat. And so you can't take that out of them. You can train them. It says every kind of beast and of birds and of serpents and all things in the sea is tamed and hath been tamed by mankind. We've tried to tame everything. The most deadly animal you can think of, you would have a better chance taming that than taming your tongue, if you don't put the effort in. So he says, look at what is in your mouth and control it, because comparing your tongue to that lion, if you take that lion and try to, you know, you can let it sit, you can give it a litter box if you want, a huge litter box, you can do everything you want in the world to try to make it like a cat. At the end of the day, it's a lion. It's a man-eating beast. You can try to tame that tongue, but if you don't watch it, at the end of the day, it is a fire, it's a world of iniquity, and it will defile the members of your body. It defiles the whole body. It's set on fire, the course of nature. And it says it's set on fire of hell. You have a better chance of taming a wild beast than you do that tongue if you don't watch it. And so he says, be grave. Don't be slanderers. Watch your tongue. Keep going in James 3. But the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poisons. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. That is profound. That you have here you have a Christian who comes to church and wants to bless God with singing, with trying to encourage a brother, and the whole week he's used his tongue for other things. He says, look, you're blessing God with the same mouth that you're cursing men. That you can't get salt water and fresh water out of the same spigot. It doesn't happen. Nature doesn't even allow that. He says, how do you expect to bless God when you're cutting your brothers down? And so he's likening that to someone that they curse men during the week, and then they come and they want to bless God with their tongues. He says, you can't do that. You can't have both. Out of the same cistern needs to come either fresh water or salt water. And we'll get into that in a little bit. But keep your finger in James 3. Turn to 1 John. 1 John chapter 4. And if you ever wonder why you try to use your tongue for the Lord and it just seems like it falls on deaf ears, or you just don't have the words to say, maybe it's the Lord teaching you that you need to use your tongue solely for me, not just, okay, now I'm ready to use my tongue for you, being that I see a situation, someone could be uplifted by it. But you need, during the week, there needs to be this consistency of you bringing forth fresh water out of your mouth, not just to God, but to your brothers and sisters in Christ and in the home. 1 John 4, verse 20. Let's start in verse 19. We love him because he first loved us. If any man say, I love God, and hateth his brother, he is a liar. For he that loveth not his brother, whom he hath seen, how can he love God, whom he hath not seen? You come into church and you say, I love God, I want to sing the praises of the Lord. But meanwhile, you're cutting your brothers down. You think that's an acceptable praise unto the God? Do you think that's something that the Lord finds pleasing? It's like a sounding brass or a tingling cymbal. It just doesn't sound right. There's just something off about someone who is, I'm not saying anyone here, I'm just saying in general, I've known people that they use their tongue for cursing, and then the same sentence they try to say praise the Lord. Just doesn't sound right. I worked with a guy down in Florida like that, and he was the worst testimony for a Christian. In fact, I wish he would have told people he wasn't a Christian just to save the embarrassment. But he was the biggest hindrance to the gospel. And he would claim to preach and claim that he wants people to be saved, but he would cuss like everyone else, and he would use his tongue for other things. So by the time he opened his mouth to witness, it was like just salt water coming out. There was nothing about it. There was no good news. There was no gospel coming out of his mouth, because 20 seconds ago, he was just cussing out the machine. Well, you can't have salt water and fresh come out of the same place. And so you need to watch your tongue. It's not just for testimony. It's just the fact that you can't have two different types of water come out at the same place. It's either going to be salt water or fresh, and we'll get to that back in James 3. But let's go back to James 3. And I already mentioned it with the sweet water and bitter, salt water and fresh. But verse 11, James 3:11, doth a fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries, either a vine figs or a vine figs? So can no fountain both yield salt water and fresh? If you want cool, fresh water from nature, where do you go? You go to the mountains, right? You go somewhere where there is a stream that has purified the water. You don't go to the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea has never produced fresh water. So why would you go there? If the Lord wants to use a tongue to glorify him, he wouldn't go to someone whose mouth is like the Dead Sea, just full of corruption. He's going to go to someone that has like the rivers of water in Psalm 1, where it's been purified and he's already been using his mouth for the Lord. He says, that's the stream. If I want good news from a far country, I'm going to use that tongue to proclaim my message. So yes, what you say in your home does matter, because the Lord is watching, and it's not just for testimony's sake, it's that the Lord sees what kind of water is coming out of your mouth. And so you need to watch that tongue. It's kind of like those old pumps that you see that where there's that flap and you have to create suction, and so you're pumping. If you saw, a lot of times if you haven't used the pump for a while, you would pump it and some junk would come out first. Eventually, if it gets down far enough into the water, it will eventually create clean water, right? But you're probably not going to put your cup under there. As soon as you see the last leaf go out, you're like, oh, boom, I'm going to put my cup under there and get clean water. You're probably going to continue to pump that thing for a couple of seconds, even a couple of minutes, to make sure that, okay, is there any more clogs of junk down there that need to get out? And so the Lord may have some time of proving to make sure that, okay, are you going to use your tongue for me? He keeps priming it and priming it and priming it. He says, okay, finally, you're clean. I can see that all the impurities are out, and I can finally get a refreshment from your tongue because it's a fresh water. Once again, it's not saying to just completely cut off your mouth and don't say anything to be safe. People need fresh water. You need to use your tongue. It's not saying don't, it's such a fire, it's such a world of iniquity, I don't want to tame the lion, I'm just going to not say anything. Yeah, but then people are going to die of dehydration. People need water. They need the gospel. They need good news. So you need to use that tongue. Just make sure that you're using it for the right reason. I already mentioned Proverbs 25:25. As cold water to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a far country. So if I want good news from someone, I'm not going to go to someone who's been using their tongue for everything but what it's supposed to be used for. Let me just go down here real quick. Something else here. But let's go back to 1 Timothy 3. So he does say to the deacon's wife, though, he says, you're supposed to be grave, not slanderers. Watch your tongue. What's interesting about that, the correlation there with the fresh water, or sweet water rather, the sweet water and bitter, is, you know, you say, well, what is it about my tongue? What causes either sweet water or bitter water to come out of my mouth? If you were to go to the end of a river and you were to take a cup and taste it and say, why is this water sweet or why is this water bitter? How could you determine what makes it water, what's sweet and what's bitter? Well, you would have to go to the source. You would have to go to the beginning, the headwaters, and see, is there something up there that is causing this to not be purified? Is there something bitter in the water? But you have to check the source of where that water is coming from. If you were to pump something and it has a bad taste to it, a lot of well water does. But if you have something that has something harmful in it, or like I said, salt water or something like that, that's not good for you to drink, you have to check the source of where you're getting that water from. And so a lot of times if you have a tongue that is unruly and you're not sure how to tame it, well, you need to check what your source is. And out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so you need to go to the headwaters and you need to check and make sure that there's not a dead animal up there or something that's making that water to be bitter, but you need to check the source, because the source will determine what eventually comes out the end of that river and whether or not that river is going to be fresh water or whether it's going to be bitter. 1 Timothy 3. So he tells the wives, even so must their wives, verse 11, even so must their wives be grave, not slanderers, sober. We already mentioned them being grave, but the soberness, you guys should know the verse, 1 Timothy 5:8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walketh about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And the soberness comes in when you realize that the people that you're trying to minister to are in danger of that very adversary. The same one that you're allured by is also trying to get the people that you're trying to minister to. So he says, be sober. Realize the ministry that you're in is not just trying to make people feel better. There's a very real adversary out to get the congregation, out to get your brothers and sisters of Christ. So he tells even the deacon's wives, be sober, understand what you're up against, and try to help people. Be serious about this. Don't take this so flippantly. Keep going. The last part of that verse, in verse 11, not slanderers, sober, faithful, in all things. Now turn to 1 Corinthians 4, and you could spend the rest of your life, and you will spend the rest of your life if you're trying to do right, just working on this one thing called faithfulness. But it says to be faithful in all things, and we'll get to the in all things part in a little bit. But when I think of faithfulness, one of the positions that we hold with the Lord, and we have a lot of positions, we are his sons, we are called his sheep, he's the shepherd, we are the clay, he's the potter. There's a lot of correlations. We are ambassadors, he's the king. But one of them is we are stewards, and he's the master. And a requirement, and I'm going to read the verse instead of explaining it without, but 1 Corinthians 4:1, let a man so account of us as the ministers of God, of Christ, and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. A requirement. What makes a steward? Faithfulness. You cannot have a steward unless he's faithful. Maybe we'll read, maybe we won't. But in Luke, actually, yeah, let's turn to Luke 16. You can be a son and not be faithful. I didn't say you'd be a good son. I'm just saying you don't lose your sonship just because you're not faithful. You do lose your stewardship if you're not faithful. And I'll show you that. Luke 16. And so it's not just that it's a good idea for stewards to be faithful. No, a steward must be found faithful. Otherwise, he's not a steward. You can be saved and not be a steward. I'm just saying, if you want to be a steward of God, faithfulness is the number one qualification. Without that, you can't be a steward. Luke 16, verse 1, and he said also unto his disciples, there was a certain rich man which had a steward, and the same came, and the same was accursed unto him that he had wasted his goods. And he called on him and said unto him, how is it that I hear this of thee? Give an account of thy stewardship, for thou mayest be no longer steward. What was his charge? It was that he wasted the goods of his master. He was not counted faithful. He wasn't trustworthy with the goods of his master. Well, then I'm going to rip your stewardship away because I can't trust you. That happens all the time. In the workplace or whatever it is, if you can't be counted faithful in the small things, we'll get to that in a little bit, how can I trust you with something big? So no, you're going to lose your stewardship. He says, give account of yourself. And this steward actually did the right thing. He went to those that owed him something and said, look, how much do you owe? He said, 100. He said, right, sit down quickly and write 50. How much do you owe? He said, 50, all right, write 20. And he went through and each one, he was a very wise steward, and he saved his stewardship because he proved himself that he could be faithful. Look at verse, I believe it's 10. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much, and he that is unjust in least is unjust also in much. If therefore ye have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? He says, look, if you're not going to be faithful in non-spiritual things, like this steward is with the master's goods, how is he, the Lord, going to trust you with true riches in the end of verse 11? And so he tells the deacon's wife, he says, be faithful in all things, not just spiritual things. And you can spend the rest of your life, and you will have to, trying to be faithful with prayer, reading, all these things that you need to have fellowship with the Lord, and you need to be faithful. But he says, be faithful in all things. Why? Because those things affect how the Lord can trust a steward. I'm not going to trust, you know, I tell the teens all the time that if there's something that I want done, and I'm going to look around the room and see who I want to pick to get something done, I'm not going to pick someone that's always late, doesn't care about anything in class, is not found faithful in other things to do a spiritual task. They may read their Bible, I don't know, but you've proven by the way you live your physical life that that's probably an indicator of how you treat this book. And so you need to be a good steward in all things. How can I trust you to do a small task if you can't fill in the blank? Do something simple, be on time, whatever it is. I don't know. I'm just saying, if I wanted to give a task to someone, I'm not going to give it to someone who always shows up late to work. So you need to be faithful, what? In all things, not just spiritual, because that bleeds into the spiritual. How you act in your day-to-day life, your job and all that, is going to affect how you are faithful to the Lord. And so when the Lord looks down for a steward, he's going to look down to someone that's been faithful already. And he says, look, you've been faithful over a little, I'll give you much. But if you're not even going to be faithful in little, then no, I'm not going to give you much. Same with the talents that the servants were over. He says, how can I give you, if you didn't use your talent and, require usury of it, I'm not going to give you a city because you're not even faithful in the little things. And so you need to be proven to be faithful. So he tells the deacon's wives, you need to be faithful in all things, not just the spiritual, but how you take care of the home, how you minister, how you are a help meet unto your husband. You know how a marriage will work is faithfulness. You know how why this church is still here? Faithfulness. You take faithfulness out of any part of your life, it will fall apart. And, it's not anything that's flashy. It's funny. I was looking through my Bible, and I read this quote. I remember a pastor talking about this years and years ago, and I write sometimes spiritual things in the front of my Bible, sometimes just funny things that I hear people say. And he was talking about faithfulness. He said, faithfulness is not flashy. In fact, I don't want to mess it up. But he said, everyone wants to be like an eagle, do all these great, fantastic things. And we're called to be like that. But sometimes it's good just to be faithful and trot on, stay on the ground. He says, eagles may soar, but gophers never get sucked into jet engines. That's faithfulness. He says, look, you're wanting to do all these magnificent things. That's fine. But at the end of the day, what the Lord's looking for is just someone that's faithful. That has maybe come here for 5-10 years, never been given recognition, never given an opportunity to preach, whatever it may be. And he's just waiting and seeing, are you going to be faithful? And you may never get any type of opportunity that you're looking for, but the Lord's not looking for that. He's looking for faithfulness. And that's what's going to make a marriage work. That's what's going to make this church continue to go on. And to be honest, that is what the Lord's looking for. He's not looking for flashy Christians. He's looking for a Christian that will just be faithful when people can see him and when they can't. And because the Lord, the eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. Let's go down back to 1 Timothy 3. So he tells them to be, the wives not to be slanderers, be sober, faithful in all things. Now he says this admonition in verse 12. He says this to the pastors earlier in the chapter, but he says, let the deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own houses well. And I think there's a very big misconception when it comes to this verse and the earlier verses when it talks let's go back up to verse 4. And I'm sorry, teens, I'm going to repeat some of this, but there's some new stuff that came in. Look at verse 4. One that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. There's gravity there again. Now, does this mean that if a pastor has a wayward child, he should not be the pastor? I'll answer it. No. How do you know that? Because you keep reading. Verse 5. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? The whole purpose of God saying, if you're going to find a pastor, find one that knows how to rule his own house and does everything he can in order to rule his house well. Why? Because how he treats and governs his family? How can I trust him with my family, the church of God, when he can't even rule his own house well? If he doesn't take that seriously and have wisdom with administering judgment on those situations in his own house, how can I trust him to rule over my family? Not rule, but how to govern and watch care over my family. Once again, kind of like a steward, how am I going to trust you with something little when I can't trust you with something little? So the family is just God testing a man, seeing how do you handle situations? How do you handle all these different things that come up? Do you handle them correctly? What is your first resort to a problem in the family? And so that way, when you're learning these lessons in the family, God's having mercy on you, and now you step into a position where you have an entire family, and this is not your children anymore, this is God's children, and now he says, all right, how did you handle that situation? I saw you handled it well. Now, here's this situation. That's the whole purpose of God putting that in there. He says, you're supposed to rule over your house well. Why? So that when you step into a position where you're trying to feed God's children, you know how to rule a house well. And you know how to, what issues do I make a big deal out of? Which ones do I not? How do I provide for my family? How do I provide for the church of God? And these things correlate so well with trying to provide for family. Every time I come home, we thankfully always have supper on the table. Okay, well, take that. If you're faithful and provide for your family there, every time you step into the pulpit, there should be a meal ready. Why? Because if you're faithful at home, it's going to translate to faithful in the pulpit. And God's going to watch that. If he looks at someone that doesn't even provide for his own, then no, I'm not going to give him a position in the pulpit because he hasn't proved himself to be faithful. That's why he says that he's supposed to rule over his own house. It's not saying that every child is going to turn out perfect. Let me ask you this. If someone leaves, let's keep in mind his family being a type of the church of God because they're both families, but let's keep the correlation. So the congregation's kind of like the kids, right? And the pastor's kind of like the dad, right? We're going to go with it. But if someone gets mad at something the preacher says and leaves, you don't blame it on the pastor, right? As long as the pastor is doing what he should be doing and is preaching the truth and one of the congregation people goes AWOL and completely goes off the charts, you don't blame the pastor, as long as the pastor's doing right. If there's a wayward child in the home, everyone says, oh, the parents, he shouldn't be the pastor anymore. Wait a second. Is he raising his kids the way he's supposed to? If so, don't go blaming the parents all the time. Sometimes there are bad pastors, there are bad parents, okay? Most of the time, though, there comes a point where if you've done everything you can, a kid still may go AWOL, and sometimes pastors' kids. Doesn't mean it disqualifies them from the ministry. Just like you being a pastor and a congregation, someone in the congregation leaves, doesn't disqualify you from being a pastor. And so you need to keep that in mind. In fact, let me just take you to Genesis 18. It's funny because I married a pastor's daughter, okay? And I promise, she has never complained about what I'm about to talk about, okay? I'm not getting my material from her. She doesn't even know that I'm saying this, okay? But it's funny because I remember Joe, there was something that he did. And, you know, kids are kids. Even pastor's kids are kids. Mind blowing. But anyways, and so they get into mischief too, apparently. And I never heard of it, but apparently Joe did. And so Joe was doing something, and it was just funny because I remember this distinctly. Joe was telling me this, and this lady comes up to him. You're a pastor's kid. I expect more out of you. It's like, okay, well, maybe you expect more out of you, but the Lord expects just as much out of your kid as he does the pastor's kid. So just saying. But this is why, there is a reason why he put this in there, all right? I'm not saying that 1 Timothy is wrong. I'm saying this is what he means by make sure that you rule your own house well. There is a reason he said that. I'm not giving an excuse for anyone to go AWOL and to reject the words. I'm just trying to give a little slack on why the Lord said what he said, to rule your own house well. Now, it should be obvious, the greatest nation on this world is not America. It's Israel. The greatest nation in eternity will be Israel. It's been around the longest. It's the one that's the apple of God's eye. Genesis, I know the current state of Israel, I'm just saying, biblically. But how did the greatest nation start? What was the reasoning for God choosing a man? Obviously, to start a nation, nations have to come from families. And so he had to choose a family. To choose a family, he had to choose a man. What was the determining factor for who should, when God looked down and said, who am I going to pick to start this great nation? I have this nation that is going to become the apple of my eye. I have a nation who from their loins will come the Messiah, my son, God incarnate, who am I going to pick? I need to pick a man to start this whole ball rolling. And we all know Abraham. But why Abraham? Look at Genesis 18 and verse 17. Let's start back in verse 16. And the men rose up from thence and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to bring them on the way. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him. Now, did all his kids, all throughout all generations, did all his kids turn out right? No, there are obviously, in every family, there's going to be people that just don't grasp spiritual things, and everyone has their own decision. But the way he says, look, I need someone to guide this great nation. I need someone that knows how to run something well, someone who's been faithful. And he says, I'm going to pick Abraham, not because of any qualifications he has, because he's a great, whatever, orator. He has all these talents. He says, I know how he rules his house, and I know that he'll command his children after him well. And so to start a great nation, he says, he looks at how he runs his house. Now, this isn't just for parents. I told the teens already, this also goes for kids. This goes for anyone. That how you act in the home, how you respect the way the Lord set up the home, is a great indicator of how you're going to be, how you're going to treat this family, the church of God. If God can't trust you to do your part in your home, how can he trust you to do your part in this church? And so, yes, God does ask you to be faithful in all things. And so it's not a real stirring anthem to let's go. It's just, it's faithfulness. It involves you just putting your head down and being faithful, not just in the spiritual, but also it just seeing if you can be reliable when the Lord needs something. I don't want to, let's go back to 1 Timothy 3. 1 Timothy 3. And so with all these qualifications that he lays out in 1 Timothy, it's not that these are, if our pastor steps one inch outside of this line, kick him off the stage. It's, look, if you're going to look for someone, this is what God's looking for. And so if you're a young man that's wanting to become a minister, whether it be a missionary, a pastor, you can. This is a good rule to go by, that these are the things that God is looking for. And you can start when you're preteen. You can start when you're 10, 12. It doesn't matter. You being faithful counts for any age. So these are not, I'm going to grow up and then now, I'm used to teaching the teens, okay? This is not things that I'm going to grow up and then when I'm 20 and 30, I'm going to start seeking the Lord. Faithfulness can be found at 5, 6, 7, 8. Once you start reading, you're accounted a steward of the mysteries of God. So back in 1 Timothy 3, verse 12, let the deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own houses well. For they that have used the office of a deacon well purchased themselves a good degree, great boldness in the faith, which is in Christ Jesus. And I'm not going to go over that too much because for the teen's sake, we went over how a man can use the office of a deacon. And you with the office of a deacon, a pastor, comes with certain responsibilities. And so you can use that. In fact, let's go back to previous verse. In verse 10. And let them also first be proved, then let them use the office of a deacon being found blameless. So you're supposed to use it. And then in verse 13, use the office of a deacon well. And so there's a way to use your deaconship that is dishonoring to the Lord. And I liken this to a friendship, where a friendship, whether you realize it or not, comes with certain responsibilities. And whether you realize that if you have a friend, that friendship comes with a certain amount of trust. That's part of a friendship, is that you naturally trust them. So you have their trust in your hands, and you can use that trust for good or ill. And same with a deacon, you have this position where you have an opportunity to use this trust and this authority to drive the church in a direction that's going to present the gospel, or you have that to run the thing the way that you would prefer it to go. So you have this opportunity to use that office for good or ill. And the sons of Eli were sons of Belial, and they used that office horribly. And in fact, so much so that when the people came to the temple, they despised the offering of the Lord because they misused and abused the office of the priest. And so a deacon can do that, and you can do that. Like I was saying about friendship, if you have a friend, I hope you have a friend. But if you can either use that friendship for good or ill. I'll give you an example. You can use that trust. That if you come to this friend with some advice, they trust what you say. That's why they're coming to you. And so if you can advise them to do good or ill, and depending on what comes out of your mouth will determine a lot of what they do. For example, you can use your influence to encourage someone to say, go on a missions trip or come out to visitation. What you're doing is you're using your friendship, you're using that office. Or you can use that as an opportunity to lead them astray to get into iniquity. And so it's just depending on how you use that. Same with a deacon, you can use that to further the gospel and the ministry of God, or you can use that to bring the church down and to demean everything that the church is trying to do. So he's cautioning them to be grave and to be sober and to use the office of a deacon well, because it comes with a responsibility. And once again, it's not just deacons, because everyone in this church has a responsibility. You have an influence on each other that you hold certain people's trust. Whether you know it or not, certain people may look at you and are judging their decisions based on what you do. And so you hold a certain amount of trust with people, whether you know it or not. And so how do you use that trust? How do you use that friendship or maybe that position that people look up to you? Are you using it for the Lord? Or are you using that trust and the way people look up to you just to have a following, just to make yourself a name? But how do you use what the Lord's given you? So to the deacons, he says, you're supposed to use the office of a deacon well. And they that do purchase to themselves a good degree and great boldness in the faith, which is in Christ Jesus. So we have a couple more minutes left, but I think I'm going to stop there. And I say pick it up next week, not in here, but Chris.
You know, Baptists historically have...